Welcome to this special web-only audio extra of Novel Agents and Emerging Strategies in the Management of Metastatic Colorectal Cancer, an audio-video CME program. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love, and we return to the interview with Dr. John Marshall, who presented a case from his practice.
So you know these kinds of ladies she is, and she keeps a little candy in her pocket. And every time she comes to see me, she wants a hug. She kisses me on the cheek and gives me a little candy that I'm supposed to eat right there. She wears, you know, fancy socks and pictures of her cats and the like. And I tell you, she's older, yes, but still pretty fit and had metastatic disease. And I tried to give her chemotherapy a couple of times. And each time, after a few cycles, she ended up with, you know, life-threatening, admit-to-the-hospital kinds of toxicities. And the chemo would work. She'd have a response, but it would take her months to recover, and she'd need rehab. And she'd keep crawling back to my office and saying, well, what are we going to do next? And I'm like, why don't we just not do anything? Because I really thought I was going to kill this woman instead of help her. And yet we had one more episode of this, and she and her husband come in, and she wants to try one more thing. So, you know, we talk about treating the elderly with chemotherapy and in general for cancer. And it's hard to predict who's going to be one of these folks that really has a rocky time, and we might hurt them, versus those patients who, you know, it's kind of smooth and easy and it works for a while. So I am very hesitantly giving this woman every other week 50% doses of irinotecan, single agent, no fluoropyrimidine. And it kind of comes back to knowing your chessboard. The colon cancer chessboard has gotten more complicated. You have now three flavors of fluoropyrimidine. You've got a couple of chemos. You've got three VEGFs, two EGFs. You got TKIs, and when to play what for what benefit. And single agent irinotecan is relatively well tolerated and does have a decent response rate in the refractory setting. So I'm just trickling a little of this in to see if I can keep her cancer slow and not bump her off in the process.
Interesting. You know, one of the tumors you hear a lot about the elderly is in myeloma for some reason. They've done all this research. They have these geriatric scales they use, and they really claim that it's very helpful in trying to decide how to dose people, et cetera. Any thoughts about, you know, the geriatric assessment, or is it more sort of gut feeling?
No, I think I haven't used such an assessment other than, you know, seeing him in the clinic. A buddy of mine, I was watching him walk his patient from our clinic to the infusion unit, which is, you know, down the hall and around the corner. And I'm like, why are you doing that? And it was great. I thought, what a great service to do. And he goes, no, I'm testing performance status. So he was, you know, it was nice, it was pleasant, but he was learning from that patient about just how tough she's going to be. And we have to remember, particularly with capecitabine, that renal function matters. So you get a little old lady with a creatinine of 1.2, well, her clearance is probably like 30. So that's a patient you want to be real careful on dosing, because it can creep up on you and knock you out. And then liver function too, particularly with irinotecan, you got to be real careful with that drug.
Yeah, the bedside tests, I've heard of a bunch of them. Another one is, can they get onto the exam table by themselves?
Yeah.
Interesting.
In the old days, I used to say, can you walk into my clinic carrying your x-rays? Well, nowadays, that's not, you know, your x-rays are on a little disc, so that's not a good test.
On your phone, maybe, at some point. Anyhow, let's talk about your 50-year-old lady.
This lady's just a fascinating case, and actually an increasingly frequent clinical situation that, honestly, I don't think any of us really knows what to do with her. So she presents with a high rectal lesion, okay, so about 12 centimeters from the anal verge, and it synchronously has three liver mets. And she presents, so before screening is supposed to be done, with an obstipation, a little bit of bleeding. So she's symptomatic with a narrowed bowel, but she's passing stool and the like. And so we get her biopsy, we get her worked up, and the first decision we have to make on this woman is, what do we do about the primary? Can we treat her with systemic therapy first, which we'd like to do, or do we pause, do we put a rectal stent in her, which would have been one option? Do we risk it and just give her some chemotherapy, knowing that a lot of responses happen early in the primaries, and so she'll stay open? And at her first tumor board presentation, because she has multiple, we actually decided to take the risk and give her some chemo. And so we did, but we withheld Bev on the first cycle, mainly because if we got into trouble with an obstructed bowel, I didn't want to have Bev on board for any surgical procedures. Now, the reason I'm not a big stent fan in this setting is that my experience, at least, particularly in de novo treatment, is having that foreign body in there with chemotherapy. Those are the people that end up perfing, at least in my hands. So I become a little gun shy of being aggressive with chemotherapy in the setting of a stent, at least an acutely placed stent. So anyway, we decided to give her some chemo. Unfortunately, she comes in cycle two, pooping a little better, bowels are moving, and CEA falling. So we're all feeling a little bit reassured that we made the right initial treatment.
Could I just ask, what was the thinking about the three liver mets? Were they considered potentially resectable?
Yeah. So, sorry, we clearly thought so. So one of the main places that I think we do a PET scan is in this patient. A baseline PET. You know, she has three spots. Are there any hidden nodes? Is that lung nodule positive or not? I want to know the lay of the land before I give her first dose. And the tumor board did feel that she would be resectable. The problem was it was bilobar, and so it wasn't going to be an easy liver resection. So basically, yeah, the plan was to do that. Now, she goes four cycles and actually has a very nice response. Now, the trick to this patient, too, is that without disclosing too much, she had two children who were going to be graduating, one from high school, one from college. And could we, in our process of curing her metastatic colon cancer, also make sure she attends both kids' graduations? So we had some timing and dancing that we had to do around that, but we made that work. So she gets four cycles of chemo, nice response, almost too nice, because now one of the lesions in the liver was getting to be pretty small. And so we made a decision at that point to back off on her chemo. Now, the second tumor board presentation is, does she need some radiation? So I voted against, whereas my radiation and surgical colleagues voted for. As surgeons have gotten better, as imaging has gotten better, I think particularly in high rectal lesions, the need for radiation to me is less.
What was going on with her symptoms from the primary?
She's good. So she's open. And this was more sort of that mindset that neoadjuvant chemo RT is a standard for rectal cancers. But, you know, as a young patient who I'm hoping is going to live a long time, and pelvic radiation is not a trivial thing. There's vaginal issues and cystitis and rectal issues. So, you know, there are more and more studies being done in rectal cancers without mets where we're just using chemo neoadjuvantly, like you guys in breast cancer with locally advanced are just using chemo and less RT. We are kind of moving that way too. So I kind of wanted that for this patient, but my multi-D team really felt that the best thing would be to do some chemo RT, gave her a little bit of capecitabine during that. Then she does a nice response there, doesn't lose any ground in the liver, so no significant regrowth. And the next tumor board was, could this be one surgery or did it have to be two? And that's really not my call, of course. And in the end, they were able to do both the liver and the rectal cancer with a temporary diverting ostomy at the same time. And she's just back in clinic, attended both graduations, and kids moving on. And now the question is, what do I do? I've got a stage four, no evidence of disease patient, high risk for relapse, no question. But, you know, do I just give her more oxaliplatin because we do? Do I give her adjuvant therapy, finishing it off for 6 months? Do I treat her to progression, which is, you know, more what I've been opting for lately? Now, in this patient, she's only had just a few rounds of oxaliplatin-based chemotherapy. So I did say, let's take her up to 8 total cycles. So that's what we're doing right now. And right now, I'm not using Bev, sort of an adjuvant way of thinking. But then, you know, what we're doing a lot of, and this is really controversial, is do you then treat that patient to progression? If she had true metastatic disease, I'd keep a little CAPE, I'd keep a little Bev going until progression. And so there's a real wrestling match with us because we've created these patients, right? We have a bunch of stage four, no evidence of disease patients and don't know what the heck to do with them. So we're debating what to do with them.
What do you do? I can tell you that we've surveyed on this question a lot. And first of all, they're kind of split. Investigators don't use biologic post-op. A lot of docs in practice do, but it seems like most people do it in an adjuvant way. They give it and they stop. What have you been doing up to now?
I kind of do what I do to me. I would quote this lady you know, a fairly high, maybe 80% relapse rate. And remember that the one study we have in terms of adjuvant therapy with metastatic disease in the liver was really negative. The Norlige study, the ERTC study, showed really no significant improvement in survival, a minor improvement in PFS, but no OS. So I don't know that we really have an adjuvant effect, a true curative delta. My thinking on this, and this is obviously not fact, it's just the way I think about it, is that in colon cancer, the drugs that work for metastatic disease have not worked in the adjuvant setting. And that really doesn't make sense. And almost all the other cancers, they do. You can use a MET drug in the adjuvant and it works. But in colon, only 5-FU and OX have worked. And so, you know, the more we've looked at this, the more we think of micrometastatic disease to me is more like a seed that's in a bag, that's in your garage, that can stay through the winter. Right? It has the same genetic information as a small plant, but they're very different beings, if you will. And I think the adjuvant setting is we're killing those seeds, those crunchy, crispy seeds. And we know that chemotherapy does not cure small plants. And so in my way of thinking, this woman probably has some other small plants around. And so the concept of maintenance therapy of treat to progression. Now, the contrast could be make her progress until you do that, because I don't know that treating her will in fact alter that course. And that's what we need is some tests looking at that.
Now, the way this lady presented initially, was she surgically resectable?
Yes. We could have done it all right de novo.
And I'm sure this was discussed in your tumor board also. Why wasn't it just done de novo?
Well, I continue, particularly with a patient like this, to have a little bias. It was not going to be a simple liver operation. It was going to be a bigger deal. The rectal lesion was going to be a big deal. You know, and then I can't get chemotherapy into her for, you know, maybe 1, 2, 3 months post-op. And so the idea of getting it in pre-op, plus, you know, the data that we do have that suggests that those patients who respond to neoadjuvant chemotherapy have a better prognosis is nice. It's reassuring that the surgery you're about to do is going to be worth it.
A couple other questions about liver-only METs. First of all, how do you approach the patient who doesn't have the primary, they've had their primary treated in the past, they present with an isolated liver MET, and they're resectable at that point? Particularly the Europeans, a lot of times will give systemic therapy, chemotherapy in a patient like that. A lot of other people, a lot of people in the U.S. just send the patient for surgery. What do you do?
Most of the time in that patient you describe, I take it out. We take it out, ask questions later. Again, we haven't really demonstrated that chemotherapy has a significant impact in that setting, so I don't want to lose that window in the right patient. The original mindset of metastatectomy was, okay, it's only one weed in the garden. If I pull that, we'll cure the patient. Where we are now is not there. We are kind of debulking patients. You know, we're doing high PEC, we're doing lung lesions, we're doing multiple liver. And I think as surgeons have gotten better, as imaging has gotten better, you can send patients for these complicated surgeries. They come back to you, no evidence of disease, and maybe they'll stay that way for 6 months or a year. Well, that's probably more successful than I could be with 6 months or a year of chemotherapy.
So another common issue with liver-only METs is the patient who's not resectable but could be resectable if there's tumor shrinkage. First of all, what's happening that you can convert somebody from not resectable to resectable? I've heard people say it's getting pulled away from the vasculature. And then what do you do? What kind of regimen do you use?
Yeah, so this is where the tumor board really becomes important. And these liver surgeons know that, you know, they've got to have a margin on a major vessel, for example. So almost always, at least for me, these are central tumors, you know, in the hilum of the liver, where if you're going to get this out of there, you're going to have to pull it off one side or the other. And of course, now we're doing things like portal vein ligations and other things to grow some liver. So we embolize, we're growing some liver, we're giving some chemo to shrink the tumor and hopefully get a setup where you can actually get the tumor out. The choice of drugs is, you know, a hot topic. You know, we're given fluoropyrimidine, so 5-FU's in. I give OX. Now, the reason I like to have OX in the recipe is, despite everything I just said, I also want an adjuvant effect. And ERI doesn't have that. So at least I want to have some OX in the mix. The biologics, I tend to use because they increase the response rate. So in a RAS mutated patient, you only got one choice. You know, you're going to use Bev. And so in that setting, this is one of the few places that I will initiate therapy with FOLFIRINOX Bev. And the TRIBE study gave us a very high response rate, a very nice progression-free survival, updated recently in Lancet Oncology. So this is a recipe you can give and you get nice tumor regression. Now, RAS wild type is more controversial. And I will say that I tend not to use EGFRs, even though there's folks who say that there's a better response rate. There is, but there is one clinical trial done in England, the EPOCH study, which basically suggested that in this very setting that we're talking about, that those patients who got cetuximab in the neoadjuvant setting fared worse, even the RAS wild-type patients. So again, I don't understand the biology. The resections were there. They all had the same percentage of resections, but their overall outcome was worse. And so this is back to that little crispy seed in the garage versus a small plant. Maybe EGFR therapy to that crispy seed is just either ineffective or not helpful. And so we're not getting that same kind of benefit. So my bias, and I realize there's another side to this story, would be 5-FU, ox at least, maybe irinotecan and some Bev.
And when do you stop the Bev if the patient's going to surgery?
So you need to give 4 to 6 weeks before. So generally what I do is 4 cycles, reassess, bring them back for cycle 5. If it looks good, give them 5, send them to, without the Bev, send them to the surgeon. Surgeon usually takes about 4 weeks to get into the OR. So now you're 6 weeks from your Bev, 4 weeks from chemotherapy.
You mentioned the FOLFOXIRI Bev regimen. What have you seen in terms of tolerance to that? And are there situations where you use it, you know, outside the issue of trying to convert somebody just as first-line therapy?
Yeah, so the answer to the last is yeah. Big bulky tumor, highly symptomatic. I think that's a nice patient to try, get that tumor back off the ledge. You know, tolerability, I never would have thought I'd say this, but the lessons we've learned from giving it in pancreas cancer have taught us how to give it in colon. So you modify, you drop your bolus, you modify your irinotecan. There are twists that you can do. A lot of people will use growth factors. I think this is one of the few places in GI cancer where growth factor makes some sense just to be able to maintain and prevent myelosuppression. But it's not that tough, but you got to know that you can't give it forever. So you use it back to the chess game. You got to use that multi-chess piece approach at the right time and for a limited duration.
So another issue I want to ask you about is management of patients with tumors with BRAF mutations. There were some data presented at the ESMO World Congress. Actually, Eric Van Cutsem is one who presented this, looking at the MEK inhibitor trametinib with dabrafenib, the BRAF inhibitor, and panitumumab, the EGFR antibody. What do you think about this approach?
They're piling on this pathway to see if they can get some clinical activity. And the answer is they are getting a little clinical activity. So, you know, we didn't talk about it, but there's evidence in the BRAF patient that FOLFIRINOX might be a better recipe in frontline metastatic colon. Clearly, when we look at EGFR therapy by itself, we're not seeing really significant benefit. And many, and I am included in this now, would argue that a BRAF mutation, I'm not excited at all about giving EGFR therapy by itself. I'm not to the point where I think it's stupid or harmful like you would with a RAS mutation, but I think it's not really helpful. So this is exciting. I think the idea of being able to pile on, the problem is these are spicy cocktails. It's not easy to give all of these drugs that pile on these pathways. And so I think what we're doing here is we're looking for signal. Can we take advantage of it? Now, you know, you keep coming back to lung cancer. I keep coming back to breast. In those diseases, these mutations are driving mutations. So if you can get a hold of them and treat them, you make dramatic changes with single agents. In colorectal cancer, what we've found is mutations that predict resistance, not responsiveness. So we've kind of thrown people out, but we haven't found a pathway, a magic bullet. The closest thing we've got is that MSI-high patient, where if you've got that biology, those drugs really, really work. We haven't found the HER2 target. We haven't found the RAS target or the EGFR target like they have in other diseases.
So another paper I want to ask you about that was also presented at the ESMO meeting recently, we've heard a lot about bevacizumab beyond progression. We actually saw a randomized trial. And at this ESMO meeting, there was a paper on cetuximab beyond progression. Any comments about that strategy and these data?
Yep. The Europeans have really embraced, in the RAS wild-type patient, using EGFR frontline. And they have some smaller data sets of re-challenging with EGFR. And in fact, what we're seeing is, again, a sort of a corny analogy. I learned that cancer was like all clonal. It was like a lawn of grass where all the blades of grass were the same and maybe one little patch over here was evolved over time. I think more and more cancer is like a forest where you have a bunch of different kinds of trees. You got your pine trees, your elm trees, your oak trees, and some of our drugs kill pine trees and some kill oak trees, right? So if you gave EGFR therapy frontline, you don't get rid of the pine trees, but you knock them back. And the argument is they regrow, and so you can re-challenge with that drug again. So they've been doing that in Europe a lot more than we have in the United States. And so this study was to try and demonstrate that if you've started with an EGFR therapy, should you continue into the second line? And the results were positive, small randomized clinical trial, but subsets and molecular profiles and all out there. But it did show that continuing it through into second line added a couple of months to your PFS. So the principle's there of keeping it going, keeping that pressure on. Remember, too, we are re-exploring the idea of combining VEGF and EGF. You and I are old enough to remember when we did that before in the BOND-2 clinical trial, which was positive. We then jumped to frontline. We didn't know anything about RAS or all of that stuff. And those studies were negative, but we're revisiting this concept of dual antibody therapy in metastatic colon in the RAS wild-type patient. I always wonder why we haven't, the DREAM study, erlotinib plus bevacizumab in the maintenance window, it was a positive study. I mean, it showed that the two together were positive. And I think it was at the time when we were poo-pooing the combination of VEGF and EGF, so we sort of threw it out, if you will. But that's sort of what's going on in lung cancer right now. And so, I, again, not driver mutations, but I wonder if we need to not throw that out and revisit that.